evening, this is Markley, and this is Inquiry. Tonight, it's a very special show. A special guest tonight, former GM of WICN, concert producer, and good friend, Brian Barlow. Brian, welcome to the show.
I'm so happy to finally be on this side.
I know. It's like we're always either on together or we've been talking, you know, behind the scenes all the time. We're often fundraising together. But I had to get you, I wanted to get you down on British Invasion music because you had to miss the British Invasion show, which was off the tracks. It was just amazing how many people still love that. And you've had so much experience of actually visiting the site. So I wanted to talk to you about that. And I'm going to start off early.
Okay.
When did you first listen to a British Invasion song that you sort of knew was special?
Well, I didn't know it was special or British Invasion, but the first thing I ever heard was, above all things, I'm going to think out her name all of a sudden here. Gosh, that's awful. I Only Want to Be With You, Dusty Springfield.
Oh, great, incredible song.
Yeah, I mean, we had Frank Ifield before that, but I didn't recognize anything special about it. But all of a sudden, one day, I heard She Loves You driving on Route 12 in my father's car, right near the rendering works. I said, what is this? I knew it was the Beatles, but I couldn't believe the sound, and I was hooked ever since.
What is it about British Invasion music? As I mentioned, when we did that show, people, even people who I think are way too young to remember it, are still into it. And it's amazing how many people are passionate about British Invasion.
Yeah, well, of course, all of us who experienced that saw this big shift in the whole culture.
It wasn't. Well, let's talk about that, too, first. Because I was a kid, and my first experience with it, my older brothers, and they're much older than me, they brought in early Stones album, all the first Stones. We had no Beatles albums in the house, but we had all the early Stones albums.
Yeah.
And then I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. And that was like that. Something else was going on other than the normal rock stuff. The songs were great, but it was more than the songs. There was a phenomena.
It was something. You know, you have to put it in perspective a bit. If you remember, prior to 1963, you know, we have a lot of faux Elvises, the Fabians, the Dion.
Oh yeah.
You had the Connie Francises. You had this industry-controlled music. You know, someone would sing, look cute, and they would have an arrangement by some other person, and the corporations run the business, and we didn't get a lot of the real black music, a lot of things, and all of a sudden, this kind of amalgam of hard rock, and we never heard hard rock before, rock and roll and skiffle all came in one magical sound of cymbals with Ringo and this driving, happy, infectious beat, and it just was so different, it made us come alive, and it kept on coming at us, through not just them, but all the other bands coming out. It was like a magic sound.
It was like a tidal wave. All of a sudden, everything was British. And I just watched, literally two nights ago, Hard Day's Night. And it's funny how rebellious those haircuts seemed at the moment.
Yeah.
People today cannot believe it.
But they were quite short, actually. Just a little bit different, that's all, from the French stylist.
But there was style to the clothes, too.
Yeah, there was a style to the clothes. It was just people were dressing up. You had the mod look, and so it was kind of a whole new shift of things. You know, I was amazed by, you know.
Now, how old were you, do you think, when you were at that point where you were really starting to get into them?
I was in high school. I was 15 years old.
Yeah, I was just about the same time.
Yeah, so, you know, it was magic. It seemed inaccessible. But I remember the first taste I ever had was Searchers. I think the very first date the Searchers ever played, just after they put the Beatles out of number one, was Worcester Auditorium.
No.
And they had the girls out in front for probably a day and a half, British flags, all those giant stairs waiting. It seemed so exciting for the energy. And we walked in, and of course, those days, that ticket was $2.
Oh, my God.
And with that.
Now, wait a minute. Were they headlining?
Yeah, it was Dick and Dee Dee, Gene Pitney, and the Searchers for $2 on that
stage. Oh, my God.
I know. And I remember I was let in because I knew the manager of the building. My mom did anyway. I sat in the front row, and they opened the doors, and this wall of the screaming girls started running towards me. And they're running so fast, so much energy, they all ran by the seats, hit the stage, and kind of bounced back and started sitting in all the general admission seats and stood on the chairs and started going crazy.
I think Needles and Pins is one of the great rock and roll songs ever.
It really is. I think in that sense that the sound it had, again, they had that magic vocal harmonies too. And it's kind of funny when you think of this, because you think of the Searchers, Jerry and the Pacemakers, and the First Invasion. When you go to Liverpool, you would not know they existed.
Are you serious?
No, I mean, Billy Jay came in the Coders, and all those bands, almost, except for on posters, which you can see, original posters and some copies, where their names are also mentioned. There's not a hint. It's Beatles, Beatles, Beatles all the way. Really, John Lennon is the star in Liverpool, and Ringo is out.
Now, why is that?
Well, he dissed Liverpool once many, many years ago on a talk show from England.
Oh, wow.
And why he didn't go back too often, even though he has gone back. And so, you'd go to the Cavern, and some people would be doing covers, often a single guitarist doing things, and they play all kinds of songs, and then somebody requests a Ringo song, and they say, no, it's a Ringo song. Or they start playing a Ringo song and say, nope, I can't go any further, it's a Ringo song. That's what they were doing at the time.
Wow.
Isn't that weird?
Wow. I can remember, we're going to get into your tours of Liverpool in a second, but I can remember in high school that there were, within the classrooms, there would actually be voting contests or who was the better band, the Dave Clark Five or the Beatles. Now, I have to say, okay, I knew that the Beatles were great at that moment, and I sort of was like sort of lukewarm on Dave Clark Five. I think I've reevaluated the Dave Clark Five since then, and they were a great band.
Well, they were a good bit. They came out of the London scene, the Tottenham Ballroom, and that was like a big cavern. I mean, it's an amazing-looking place. And they were very good, but, you know, they didn't have that depth. I don't know whether there's a social connection. It was just all fun, beat music. I liked them, and they were good-looking. But I had that argument many times in high school with these girls. They all liked the Dave Clark Five better. I said,
I know. I couldn't believe how many times the Dave Clark Five won.
Yeah. I have magazines still to show that.
Oh, really?
Versus Dave Clark. Or in this country, it's Beatles versus the Four Seasons.
No.
Yes.
With the sound of Frankie Valli.
Yeah. Well, that's part of it, too. I have a magazine to show.
So that was like an America versus Britain kind of thing.
Yeah. It was never the Beach Boys. It was always the Four Seasons because they had so many hits.
I know. Brian Wilson talked about when the British hits started to come in. I can remember this old interview with him. And he was just, he was knocked off his game.
Yeah,
he was just that the songs were so beautiful, they were so perfect. He just felt he could never match them, and it was just sad. But I mean, it's really strange to think about Frankie Valli versus the Beatles.
Well, you know, that's the commercial side of the adults still running the world at that time saw those things like that. You know, of these teen magazines, but
and there was the shows like Hullabaloo.
Yeah, but that started, that was the whole thing. They were run by adults, but quickly we were seeing that whole industry being transformed from an adult world to a young man's world where they took over the business.
That's right.
And started the freed up until the corporations came in again because they saw the money and took it over again in the early 70s. But that free period there in the 60s was wild in every way.
Did you ever get a chance to see the Beatles?
Yeah. They played in
that's Boston. That's no small thing. That's no small thing.
No, it was almost not going to go because I was outraged by the price of the tickets. I was paying $2-3 to see the biggest bands in the country here, but I had to pay $6.50 to see.
Are you kidding? And you were outraged?
Well, it seemed expensive. That's probably like $60 then to me. But they played at Suffolk Downs, and they had the Ronettes opened up for them, Bury the Remains, and I think the guy who was saying Boston guy. I'm going to blank on his name. But, you know, I heard him loud and clear because Terry Hanley did the sound, and he was one of the first to provide some big concert speakers. So it's outdoors, and I heard even Paul playing yesterday.
Oh, wow.
A half-hour show by the Beatles, and the bands filled up the other thing, but the crowd went wild, but it was well heard.
Now, so, did the charisma translate in person in a big stadium like that?
Yeah, no, they did. The sound was just like the Beatles, except they really, you know, I wanted to hear some original kind of really good tunes they heard, but they pulled off a lot of the lesser ones like I'm Down or Long Tall Sally. They did play Babies in Black and Yesterday, but some of the stuff I wanted to hear, or the Sgt. Pepper stuff I didn't know was coming, it wasn't there. It was kind of like just get it done and go kind of show, but they still were great to see.
Oh, man.
Just great to see. You know, there they were right in front of me, not that far away. And it's hard. They were like gods to me at that time.
Oh, I totally see that. This is another reason to invent a time machine.
I'd go back and see that.
Now, one of the things that's been amazing to me ever since we've known you is you've gone to Britain several times.
Yeah.
And visited all the sites. Now, talk to me about going and doing that. Like, what was the first time you went and decided that you were going to do the tour?
Well, I wrote it comes from Pete Best, because if you remember, Pete Best came and Joe Zupan interviewed him for several hours, I think, on the radio.
Right.
And after I chatted with him for a while to talk about things, he talked about his mom and the Casbah, which at that time had not opened. The Casbah was one of the first places the Beatles ever played. in West Derby, and he thought about reopening it. And so I heard that he did, and so I decided to go and see this whole thing. And just as a whim, see London and then go to Liverpool. And I just fell in love with the town because in my world, it was a bit like Worcester. In that everyone knew everybody, it had lots of hills, everyone knew all the neighborhoods. But the ironic thing is that all that Beatles magic, that mystery, everything is there right in the town. You can see where it came from, like Strawberry Fields. You know, it's an orphanage that was across the street from John Lennon's house. Penny Lane exists. It was a bus route they took. And it just goes on and on, these little neighborhood things everywhere. And so I said, wow, look at this. It kind of demystifies them in some way, but it sees that Liverpool is a charming, charming place with friendly people who love to talk, they love to laugh. And for that alone, I went back, but then there's all those Beatles sites.
So talk to me. You went to the Cavern?
Yeah, the Cavern, which is a funny thing because the Cavern wasn't really the Cavern. It's hard to describe, but the Cavern was once a air raid shelter way back in the war, then became a fruit market. There was big buildings on top, and they were just like a big stone thing down below. And eventually, someone decided to make a jazz club there in 57. And it was strict jazz, but skiffle was allowed. I think even the Quarrymen played there. But eventually, it opened up and became this club for a while with the Beatles, and you know all that. But when the Beatles and all those bands left, believe it or not, good for the world, but Liverpool died. All their bands were gone touring internationally. And the club closed in 73.
Oh,
and
wow.
They were going to take it down by the Metrorail to build some exhaust systems for the new subway they hoped to build. So they smashed the whole building down. But it still kind of remained together underground. So they sold 5,000 bricks to kind of get it restored and gave some money to the Strawberry Fields. And then they took all the other bricks and they kind of rebuilt the exact same looking place at a 90-degree angle to where it was, so the stage is kind of near where it really was. And it covers about 70% of the original floor, but it's not the old Cavern. But it's still cool to go down.
So what's it like? I mean, how big a place is it?
Oh, it's very tiny. How do you describe it? It's all stone, a stone floor. It's got the arched walls. I'd say it's probably 20 feet wide by about 50 feet deep.
Oh, wow.
About it. And it's, well, they put 200 people in that room all the time, and they had one bathroom, and it always overflowed, so it was all urine on the floor. Not in the tourist way, but in those old days. But bands play there all day from 12 to about 10, 12 at midnight. All Beatles tribute bands, mostly. And sometimes real bands come back and play there, too. So it's kind of a cool place, but you walk down the big, winding staircase to get down there and take a little left, and there it is, all reproduced as best it could be with all that painting on the back wall, you know, on the arch wall, and all the names being signed. So it's a pretty cool place. And they have Beatles covers at night. You go down there instead in the big, big crowd, and it looks like the Beatles are playing in the Cavern exactly as the little films you may have seen.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of cool. Really
wow.
Cool.
So wait, you're saying that there are bands that are playing, like, all the time there now? That
yeah. 12 o'clock, well, 10 o'clock it starts. It's free from 10 to 12, then depending what band, you might pay a few bucks to get, or a few pounds to get in.
Oh, nice.
And it's still cool, and we occasionally have some great cover bands, like the Beatles bands, and it's just kind of an interesting atmosphere. They have great bar there, and great music, great souvenirs. It's kind of commercial. It's owned by the Magical Mystery Tour Properties, and they bought it out. But it's cool, but it's not authentic. If you really want to have a Beatles experience, I always say go visit the Casbah. That's untouched.
Oh, talk to me about that.
Well, Mona Best was kind of entrepreneurial. She had her son playing the drums, and they saw an opportunity to do something, so they opened a kids' club up in their cellar. And she had a big house because she married a very wealthy guy named Johnny Best, who was a big boxing promoter. And it had this house downstairs. They thought, let's have a club. And she was so smart, she started to sell memberships to this club to get people to come in.
Oh, wow.
And they brought in local bands in there. But the club is so weird. Like, one of the stages, the room was probably 6 feet wide by about 10 feet deep. And that was where the stage was. And it was all like almost a cross of rooms.
Oh,
and they started getting so packed that they decided to open up a little more and knock down a wall. And then when the Beatles started to play there a lot, they started getting press oppressed by the crowd, so they had to build a little iron fence around them. You might see the pictures of the big spider web on the back wall.
Yeah.
Casbah, and that's where they played. But it was a tiny spot, and when you go there, all the paintings John Lennon did on the ceiling, the Egyptian things, the stars he painted, is all still there. The piano's still there. The Beatles' box system's still there. The record player they used in breaks still sitting there. The refrigerator's still there. It's all original.
Oh,
and the
wow.
Or in the machine. And when I was there, I had a private tour with Rogue because of my relationship with Pete, and he brought down the leather pants they wore in those days in the Hamburg and John's harmonica, microphones that Paul used to sing, and there's a picture of him singing on it, and there we had him, and it just was like the real deal. It's a cool spot, a cool story to be heard about that whole place. They played there 20, 30, 40 times at least.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Now, if a person would want to go there, you have to make a reservation?
Yes and no. Most people take tours.
Okay.
And there's a lot of tours in Liverpool, from maritime tours to everything. But everyone hears about the Magical Mystery Tour, which is the most famous one. But it's a big bus, and it's kind of a drag. If you're going, I'd recommend the Beatles Taxi Tours, where an individual will take you right on the taxi and show you all the sights, or even show you things you didn't think you wanted to see if you know more, and dig into it pretty deeply. But it's about $60, I think, and you give a nice tip, and it's about, £60 or so, I should say. So
wow.
But two or three people get in the taxi and go to all the spots, the houses they lived in, stuff like that.
Is the houses still extant? They're still up?
Well, all the houses are still there. There's two of them that are owned now by the National Trust, and that's John Lennon's and Paul McCartney's.
So they're historical sites.
They're historical sites. But they're still there intact. The furniture is different, but they're made to look exactly like the times. So, you know, you have to kind of register with the National Trust to go into those two houses. You can drive by them, you know, and that's what everyone does in most tours. But if you do that method, you'll get in. And, you know, I sat in John Lennon's bedroom overlooking that little famous, it was a little porch, was glassed-in porch. We did all this practicing because of the echo, and all that stuff still sits there.
Wow. Whoa!
Come on,
you have to have gotten vibes from doing that.
Well, I looked at it and I thought, you know, here you guys, the guy's famous. He comes home, brings home his guitar, and puts it in that closet, in his Beatles suit, puts it in the closet, lays in the bed for all those years. And then Paul's house in Fourth and Road, the same thing. Brought back that Hofner bass for Albie, put it in that same closet, put his clothes off there. And he just looked at the window. There was a pipe outside his window where he'd sneak out at night to go to the band to sneak back to get back.
Oh, he's shimmying up and down the pipe?
Yeah, if you look at his house in Fourth and Road, you'll see just that. There's a big pipe outside his bedroom window. It's his bedroom window is above the door in front of the picture on Fourth and Road. So he'd shimmy out to get it because his father didn't like it that much, especially with that evil John Lennon who walked down the street to see it.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch, my special guest tonight. I'm amazed that you got to see all these sites. And again, I was introducing you, my guest tonight, former GM of WICN and concert producer Brian Barlow. When you were here as the GM, I can remember we would talk rock every morning when you came in. You came in early. And before I went to record shows, and inevitably we get down to British Invasion. I wanted to ask you, is there a specific time period for you that British Invasion sort of begins and ends?
Yeah.
And it can be personal. I'm not asking for like an absolute, but for you, when does it end?
Well, I think for the most part, the whole 60s started in 1964, ended about 68. You know, that was that whole classic thing. And with that, the invasion was kind of over, too, I thought. You know,
like the psychedelia that came in and then ushered it out?
Yeah, I mean, because no longer the British invasion here. America took over with the Byrds and psychedelia and all those great bands came out of the West Coast. And the Beatles were leading still the way, but that was not an invasion anymore. They were just, you know, the kings of the music scene because they were so brilliant. So to me, it was just the invasion with the mop tops and all that was certainly 64, 65, 66. 67, iffy, you know, although it was Sgt. Pepper's, but that was a whole new art form now.
I'm amazed at the music that's being released now from that time period, say 63 to 67.
Yeah.
It's generally out on British labels. Like there's a female vocal artist, British artist from 1967, and it's a huge CD collection of these vocal artists I'd never heard of, and they were great, and they were all part of that whole scene. And of course, there were great known female artists like Lulu. Let's talk about some other acts that you like or songs that you like. For me, Ferry Cross the Mersey by Jerry and the Pacemakers.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the most beautiful songs.
Well, it is, and it sort of put a magic on the Mersey River. The Mersey River itself is not a very pretty spot. But
oh, really?
No, well, it's just if you go out to Albert's Docks or Pierhead, they've been knocked down and made into museums and cool things. But the water is just the water, and the tugboats are just, you know, the boats are just the boats. It's a big, big river. When you go out there, it's like the ocean almost. It's so big.
Oh, wow.
You can see across the way a bit, but it's still a lot of magic went into that. I got to tell you, a sidebar, quick before we get to answer your question, but I just remembered recently, but Tula Clark, who was a big star
at
that period of time, she had one big hit called I Know a Place.
Right.
That was about the cavern.
Oh.
You know,
I hate to admit this, but I did not know that.
Well, it was, you know, I Know a Place where people go and the lights are low, and the cellar full of noise. It's a pretty well-known reference to the cavern club. So.
Didn't she also do Downtown?
Yeah, she did Downtown as well. She had a lot of big hits. She was older than most people, but still young, comparatively. Still around touring and playing, too, by the way.
If I was to ask you some of your other favorite acts, aside from the Beatles, from the British Invasion.
Well, I have to lead on a couple. Manfred Mann was great.
Oh, fantastic.
Doo Wah Diddy when it first came out. And also, the Zombies had that sound, too, you know. To Tell Her No and She's Not There. That was killer, too.
The Zombies were amazing. I got to interview the guitarist, I think it was last year, of the Zombies, of the original Zombies.
Yeah, I mean, they were kind of after the Invasion, but still part of that whole thing. But if you go back to the original Invasion, I think, you know, I love the sound of the Searchers. They were.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Brian Epstein. That's why they didn't get as much play, but they were from Liverpool and just had a magical sound.
Well, let me ask you about some groups then. Herman's Hermits.
Yeah.
Peter Noone is still touring, isn't he?
Yeah, well, he was very young. Remember, he was like 17 when he first became famous. So I saw him play maybe in the ranch 5 years ago, and he still looks good. The band was actually excellent.
How's his voice?
Perfect.
And he did all the hits?
Yeah, I mean, he has actually a very tight band. So, you know, I saw Chad and Jeremy with them at one point, too, and they were extremely talented, too. But then other bands like Billy J. Kramer and the Coders I saw, they were awful. Just awful.
I always find that so sad when they're touring beyond the time that they should be.
Yeah.
That's like fingernails on a chalkboard.
Yeah.
It's like you want them to be good. You really want, and you're really willing to cut them some slack. And when they even get below that, then you just feel so bad.
Yeah, I know. And it's tough. But then, of course, when you have a lot of these tours with 4, 5, 6 acts on there, it's bound to have a couple that open up like that. So, but it's nice to know they're still out there doing a good job. Zombies are still touring, or were until the COVID
came. Yep, that's
so they're still sounding pretty good. So I have to ask you to return, though. If you have to think of a band that's pretty well unknown from the really British Invasion that stood out for you, who would that be?
Oh, and I know what it's going to be because I know that you know who they are.
I don't know. Tell me.
Dave D, Dozy, Beaky, Mick, and Titch.
They are a good one. They are a good one.
See, I never even heard of them while I was living through it. And then I get some of these British Invasion collections, and I got Zabadak.
Yes.
And then I thought I was going to spring it on you, and you knew who they were.
Yeah, well, they had a couple of hits. They were in one of the Pulp Fiction movies, I think.
Yep.
But my band, with all things, was the Four Pennies. I thought they were wonderful with the Berries, Dave Berry. And they did a song called Juliet, very sweet, luscious little ballad. And I love that sweet, sweet sound they had. And no one probably remembers them at all.
Here's another one, and I think, and I just, something down my Facebook feed just came up about them. Unit 4 Plus 2.
Yeah, Concrete and Clay.
That's a great song.
It is a great song. Very unique sound, unlike anything else, too. That kind of weird, I don't know, calypso rhythm, whatever it was called.
Yeah, that really stood out. I mean, people don't realize this music was just coming at us. Like it was like every week.
Every week there's something brand new coming out.
But a lot of big bands got that were huge in the later 60s into the 70s got their start during this period too. That includes the Kinks.
Yeah, it's true.
And the early Who was really started just at the tail end.
Well, even things like the crossovers, if you look at Wayne Fontaine and the Mindbenders, they kind of turned into 10cc.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Little transition. So, you know, they kept on staying in the business, basically.
Would you consider the Yardbirds part of that? The British Invasion, or was it on the cusp?
Yes and no. I mean, they were the blues band thing coming out, which was the Stones doing the same thing, too.
I noticed you don't talk about the Stones.
What's that?
You don't talk about the Stones.
I love the Rolling Stones, but I really thought they kind of lost it about 10 years ago, became a cover band.
But how about back then? Back then.
Oh, then I saw them in '65 at the Auditorium before they had the Satisfaction out, and they were great. That Stone period, I love the early Stones.
That's what I love. I'm not hot on the later Stones at all.
Yeah, I had the privilege of having Bill Wyman, the bass player, at my house over for a whole weekend once when they had them booked into Mechanics Hall. Not the Stones, but Bill Wyman's Rhythm Kings. And he told me all about why he left, and he said basically the same thing. He says they started just, you know, being a cover band for themselves. They've kind of lost their mojo and magic, and decided to get out.
Was he saying they were just sort of basically pretending to be the Stones?
Yeah, he says it just wasn't the same for him anymore, and he decided to leave.
Oh.
But the early Stones were tremendous, but they weren't like, I don't know, the magic that came from that, maybe the poppy, happy thing the Beatles were. But they still sounded so good. Those first two or three albums were fantastic, you know?
Well, I was just, when I was doing the show a couple of weeks ago about British Invasion, I was reading from the history of British Invasion called Ready, Steady, Go.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And I was reading that the Stones were really positioned as the anti-Beatles.
Yeah, it's so funny, you know, we think of that. Because in reality, the Beatles were really not very nice people. They're tough, they stole, they burned their apartments down, they made a lot of girls hit them, and they were really greasy, grimy, and dirty.
How did they get this, when you see them in Hard Day's Night, they look so clean, like Paul's grandfather. They look so clean.
Well, Brian Epstein was going to manage him, of course, as you know, everyone knows that. But he had to clean them up. He thought they'd be more successful. Brian was very natty in his own way with the suits and ties.
Yep.
But the Stones were the nicest of people, and so they took their first photographs to get them out there. Andrew Luke Holden was taking the pictures. He wanted to manage them, and they couldn't stop him from smiling, being polite. He had to take several photos to get one mean one to make him look like the alternative to the Beatles. It's kind of funny to think of that. So
that I cannot imagine, because they've self-cultivated this image of the bad boys, and I don't know what they would do without it.
I don't know either, but they did become a little bad, I guess. But the Beatles were the rough guys, the tough guys. They went through it all, basically. So, hey, and a sidebar, by the way, I have to say this to you, just about the Liverpool. I don't know why I want to say this now, but the heart of Liverpool was torn down, you know, because it was really rough, rough area. Paradise Street and all this stuff. They made it kind of like a big cement outdoor mall. But when you go see where the Cavern is, that's all still original on Matthew Street. It's all original cobblestones, all original buildings. But of all things, the old NEMS building where Brian Epstein had the record store, which was very near walking the Cavern, just like 1,000 feet, now is a Forever 21. But at least you can see where it is and see the old.
Oh, man.
Liverpool, but it's still all there besides that one center. But you can see how easy it was for them to say, let's just shoot up the street, walk into this Cavern. It was literally 1,000 feet up this windy little street.
Brian, we're all out of time.
We are.
I'm going to have you back.
Well, we haven't talked about anything.
This reminds me of the conversations we used to get into before both of us would go on the air.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. If people only knew, this went on every single day.
About every day. Sorry, it was fun to talk.
It was incredible. I really miss it. My special guest tonight is former GM of WICN, constant producer and good friend, Brian Barlow. We've been talking about British Invasion. I'm compelled every year I have to do a British Invasion show. I just did it. I may find another way to squeak another one in. Brian, I'm going to have you back because we got to talk about some other music stuff.
Love it. Anytime, Mark.
I want to talk about people who've come down to WICN.
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
I know.
It's surprising how many people.
I know. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.